It is the 10th July, 2020, and this is the Morning Bible Study. Well, if you are and have been following along, which I hope you have, then you will know that we are in the second half of 2 Samuel chapter 16, beginning in verses 15 through 23. So it's really not the second half. It's kind of like the last third, but we did the first two-thirds yesterday, so we're going to call it a half, because you know what? That's how people in real life use the word half. You know, mathematicians get all upset about that, and math teachers and stuff. No, it's not a half. We understand. Those of us who live in the real world, we understand that half just means when you divide something by two, you know. And sometimes you have a bigger half, sometimes you have a smaller half, not even divided by two. When you have two things, you know, like two parts of a whole, doesn't matter if the one part is bigger than the other part, you know, like, in common parlance, we just say half. Why am I talking about this? I don't know. But we're in the second half. I'm going to keep saying half because why not, you know? So we're in this last part of chapter 16. So go ahead and why don't you read chapter 16, verses 15 through 23. And it really wouldn't be a bad idea to read all of chapter 16 if you want to get a little bit bigger, reminder of where we are. But, I mean, really, you could read all of, you know, Second Samuel beginning in, I mean, all the way back in, what is it, chapter 11? I mean, you could probably start in chapter 10 and read all the way through if you really wanted some broader context. But anyways, just read the text. Read as much as you want. How about that? Let's just say, read as much as you want. When you're done reading, then go ahead and unpause the audio, and we will dive into the study. Okay, so beginning at verse 15, and we're just going to walk through this text because there's a lot of theological significance to this, a lot of significance to the believer today. But the text itself is actually rather simple, and there really isn't that much there. I mean, there are eight verses. So we see now when Absalom and all of the men of Israel, okay, so again, all the people, all the men of Israel arrived in Jerusalem. Okay, so when it says all of the men of Israel, that's clearly not true. Okay, that is obviously not what happened, because there were people with David who were men of Israel who were not there, right? There were people all over. So when it says all of the men of Israel, right, we can say with absolute confidence that it's not meant to be taken literally as all the men of Israel. We can also say with very strong confidence that it may not actually even mean the majority of the men of Israel. What it probably means is that there were men there who were representative leaders from all of the tribes and important people from all over Israel. Okay, that's what I think that means. And it was a large sum of people. But what we see when we look at the text is that actually this expression, all the men of Israel, is used a lot in 2 Samuel, particularly 2 Samuel, and particularly in this clustering we're looking at, this story of David's fall. And it's used disproportionately in 2 Samuel versus the rest of the Bible. So that expression, all the men of Israel, where you have a collocation of those three words, well, that comes 14 times in 2 Samuel, okay? But it only comes 106 times in the rest of the entire Old Testament. Okay, so that means that there's a high density of that in 2 Samuel. Well, how do I know that? Well, because there are, you know, roughly 39 books in the Old Testament. Now, some of them are shorter, some of them are longer, and 2 Samuel is a longer book, but it's not nearly as long as some of the other books. So when you average everything out, you would expect, you know, for a book this size, that maybe it would have, you know, maybe 5% of the uses, but it doesn't. It has nearly 10% of the uses. So this expression is used, it's used about twice as often as you would expect in a book of its size. Okay, that's just me doing some, you know, back of the napkin math. Okay, I don't know the exact word count, you know, for you know, the average book versus 2 Samuel, but 2 Samuel is not an incredibly long book, and the fact that it has 10% of the uses of the term all of the men of Israel means that it stands out as an expression, right? So we look at that, and then, so for example, all right, so 106 times all the men of Israel is used. It's used once in Genesis. It's used 6 times in Exodus. Four or five times in Leviticus. And then maybe 7 or 8 times in Numbers. 3 or 4 times in Deuteronomy. And then quite a few times in Joshua, 7 times in Joshua, quite a few times in a lot of times in Judges. And in fact, it's used a whole bunch in chapter 20 of Judges. In fact, holy macaroni. You want to talk about a density of the expression, all the men of Israel. Judges chapter 1, about the civil war between the Israelites. Man, oh man, you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 times. That might be the most dense place in the entire Bible. You got 11 times there in one chapter of Judges. Okay, 1 Samuel. Okay, so you've got once in Ruth, you got 1 Samuel. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 9 times in 1 Samuel. Then 2 Samuel. 1. And I know there are 14. So in the Samuel material, you've got 23 times. That's almost 25% of all the usages happen in Samuel. Okay, and then you've got a pretty decent number of times in 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 1 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles, which we would expect because those are repeating some of the same material. And Nehemiah a couple times, Jeremiah a handful of times, Ezekiel a handful of times, Daniel once, no Isaiah, no minor prophets. I mean, now why am I doing this? Why am I taking all my time to go through this with you? Because this is part of how Bible study happens. This is part of how a pastor should, anyways, go through and go through the scriptures in a way that helps people understand what things are worth noticing. Okay, so why do I know that all the men of Israel is worth noticing? How do I even know that to begin with before having done this study? Well, here's how I know. Okay, because I know from previous reading of the Bible, from previous study and from preaching that I've done before, that all the men of Israel is a theologically significant expression. It is a theologically significant expression. Now, how do I know that? Well, like I said, I'm cheating. I'm reading ahead, okay? But look at what happens in the next section, okay? I don't want to give away too much here. But in the next section, when we look at the advice of Hushai the Archite, who is trying to undermine the advice of Ahithophel, what happens? Hushai, who's trying to give Absalom bad advice, we know he's trying to give Absalom bad advice. What does he say? He says, "My advice, therefore, is this: let all Israel from Dan to Beersheba be mustered to you to lead them personally into battle." Now, we'll talk tomorrow. Monday, we'll talk about this. We'll talk about why this is significant. But obviously, we know why it's significant. If you're thinking ahead, if you want, I'll give you this. It played to Absalom's vanity. But look at what it is. All Israel from Dan to Beersheba. You know, this expression, all of Israel, is significant in this portion. And we know that it wasn't actually all of Israel. Again, this is playing to Absalom's vanity. And this is a reminder that this rebellion was widespread. It was widespread. It involved a lot of people. And it was a serious threat to the throne of David. Okay, so getting that out of the way, and you're like, wow, Luke, like, these are supposed to be 15-minute Bible studies, and we just spent half of it on the first verse talking about this expression that you said we shouldn't take literally anyways. Okay, right, I know. But here's the point, friends. The ability to search for expressions like this, the ability to know, and good Bible translations, if you have a good modern translation, you can kind of do this on your own to an extent. And then with a concordance, or, you know, like if you have a pastor who's willing to do research for you, wink, wink, you can't see me winking because this is on, you know, it's recorded, but audio, this is recorded audio. Like, I guess if it was recorded video, you could see me winking. But if you have a pastor who's willing to do this kind of research for you, wink, wink, you know, you can ask him. It's like, hey, Luke, I've noticed that, you know, this expression gets used a couple times. Is that important? And you know what I'll do? I'll go to my computer. I'll do a quick search, and we'll do exactly what I did. We'll look at how often the word is used. We'll see if it's a rare word. We'll see if it's used in a non-standard way. And if any of those things are true, you know, like if it's a rare word, if it's used in a non-standard way, or if it's a word that has particular density or only shows up in significant theological clusters or in theologically significant positions, we can say, yeah, it's probably a very important word here. Nice catch. And then we'll have high fives, and then we'll go get, you know, like milkshakes maybe. I don't know. I'm just all about milkshakes. Just saying. So that's the good thing. That's why reading the Bible over and over and over again benefits you. That's why it pays off, because you begin to notice these things that you might not have noticed otherwise. You begin to notice things that maybe you just glossed over, or maybe you just breezed over because you were looking for the meaning of the text and maybe you weren't looking at the structure of the text. Looking at structure helps us understand meaning. It helps us understand meaning at a deeper level. Okay? It's like I've told people before, it's the difference between appreciation and just listening to music. You know, like if you want to really appreciate music, right? Not only do you have to listen to it and enjoy it, but you have to understand it. When understanding and enjoyment combine, that's when you get appreciation. Right? Now I can listen, I can look at all sorts of things that I don't really understand. And so I like them, but I don't really appreciate them, right? Like I can look at a beautiful car that's been restored, and I have no idea what kind of work was involved in restoring that. Or I really don't. And so to me, it's beautiful. But to a car guy looks at that car or that motorcycle or whatever, and they know how much work went into it. And they don't just enjoy it, they appreciate it. They appreciate it. You know, when I read, you know, a well-written novel, I know what kind of work goes into writing. And so I appreciate it. Not only do I enjoy the story, but I love to watch the way the story was structured. Or a sermon. When I listen to a great sermon, not only am I noticing the words and the way that it's presented and enjoying it as the truth of God being proclaimed, but I appreciate it because I see the way that it's been structured. I see the work that went into it, and I have an understanding of what's going on. What we as Bible readers should be wanting to do is not just want to be Bible enjoyers. We should be Bible appreciators. We need our enjoyment to combine with understanding, and that's when appreciation comes. But anyways, I am quickly running out of time, and that's because I am letting myself gab. I told myself, I'm like, hey, I've got a shorter section. I've got all sorts of time in the world. Go ahead, Luke. Just let your mouth run, and that's when I run out of time. So Absalom, so Hushai comes, okay? Hushai the Archite comes, and he says, long live the king, long live the king. And Absalom says, do you call this loyalty to your friend? Why didn't you go with your friend? And Hushai replied to him, no, I will be loyal to the one whom the Lord, these people, and all the men of Israel have chosen. Now, man, is that flattery or what? Is that flattery or what? I mean, come on, man. Come on. That level of flattery is impressive. I mean, it really, really is. That kind of ingratiating yourself, look at who are the people who chose him. Okay, look at who are the people who chose him. God and all the people of Israel. God himself and all the men of Israel. We see a clustering of this expression being used where we see, you know, all the men of Israel are there. All the Israelite men, they just love him so much. They can't get enough of him. They just want more of him. Okay, so that's one of the 1, 2, 3, 4 places that all Israel is used in this chapter, in chapter 16. Okay, so it's remember, there's a lot of density here, a lot of density of this expression. And he says, moreover, whom should I serve? Should it not be his son? Just as I serve the Father, so will I serve you. Now, that's, by the way, okay, friends, that's what we call dramatic irony, okay? That's what we call dramatic irony. And it was meant, Absalom took it in one way, and the text clearly presents that in another way, okay? So Hushai says, I'll be loyal to the one whom the Lord, these people, and all the men of Israel have chosen. Did he actually say, I'm serving you? No. No, he didn't. He didn't say, I'll serve you, Absalom. He says, I will serve the one whom Yahweh, these people, and all the men of Israel have chosen. That's kind of being tricky. That's kind of being a sneaky sneak with your words. Is he actually saying he's going to serve Absalom? Nope. And then he says, moreover, whom should I serve? Should it not be his son? Okay. Well, why shouldn't I serve the son? He says, just as I served your father, so I will serve you. Now that is really interesting, because what did he just accuse him of? He accuses him of disloyalty. He's like, hey, you should have hung out with your friend. Why didn't you stay with your friend? What are you, disloyal? How can I trust you, you disloyal guy? And he says, hey, no, just as I served your dad, so I'll serve you. Wait a second. You're being accused of disloyalty, and you're saying, like, I'm going to treat you the exact same way that I treated your dad. Okay, that's... If Absalom weren't such a vain peacock of a man, he would have recognized that maybe there's more, you know, maybe there's some more cross-examination worthy of doing, but the supposed flattery that he gives is enough. And so Absalom says to Ahithophel, not Hushai, he says to Ahithophel, he says, give us your advice. What should we do? Ahithophel replied to Absalom, have sex with your father's concubines, whom he left to care for the palace. All Israel will hear that you have made yourself repulsive to your father. Wait a minute. All Israel will hear. Wasn't all Israel here already? How are they going to hear if they're already here? Oh, wait. Yeah, because not all Israel is actually there. Okay, it's not meant to be taken as a literal expression. They will hear that you've made yourself repulsive to your father. By the way, that expression, repulsive to your father, that means a stench in his nostrils. The nose, the word for anger is also the word for nose. You know, so somebody who's patient is long of nose. And the idea is that if you're long-nosed, it will take a long time for the stink in your nostrils to get to your nose. And so the nose is actually like a really significant body part in biblical theology. Now remember, this is a world before air conditioning. This is a world before indoor plumbing. This is a world before the automobile. And like, this is a world before, you know, large-scale public sanitation. The ancient world was a much, much stinkier world than today's world. Much stinkier world. I mean, this is a world before speed stick deodorant and Axe body. Well, it might actually be a good thing that it was the world before Axe body spray, but it was the world before cheaply available deodorants. Okay? So a stench in your nostrils is, and by the way, the Israelites still bathed a lot, probably compared to some other ancient peoples, but this is important to them. Like, bad smells are something that are pretty much unavoidable in that society. And so things that would smell good would be of incredibly high value, especially things that are strong smells that are able to cover over the stenches of people and animals and feces and urine and anything that happens to be rotting in the city at that time, right? So smells are significant, and they bore a more important place in life then than they do in most Americans' lives today. Now, some of us who grew up in farming communities, some of us who grew up taking care of livestock, we know a little bit about stink, but, you know, I think you could multiply that stink a little bit for most people and in most situations, okay? So when you talk about a stench in somebody's nostrils, what is a stench in your nostrils? It's this smell that is repugnant to you, that is repulsive to you, that frankly you can't get away from, right? You ever have a dead mouse in your walls? What can you do? Live with it. I mean, you can try to find the dead mouse and rip your walls up, but, you know, good luck with that. We all know that sometimes there just stinks that you've just got to live with, right? Anybody who's raised children knows that sometimes those diapers, they will stink up the house. You know, even if you have cloth diapering, you know, like we do cloth diapering, you know, you spray those out, you flush it down the toilet, and still you got that stinky diaper, you know. So a stench in your nostrils is something that is repulsive that you either need to get away from or you need to get it away from you. It's not just going to go away. You need to do something about it. Okay, so this is significant. This is theologically significant language, that there is a stench in your nostrils. And what is he saying? He's saying that if you do this, we're going to draw your father out for a fight because he cannot do this. Basically, what he's saying, we'll come back to that. So they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof, and Absalom had sex with his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. In those days, Ahithophel's advice was considered as valuable as a prophetic revelation. Both David and Absalom highly regarded the advice of Ahithophel. That's the Net Bible kind of churches that up. The advice of Ahithophel in those days was like when one inquires of the Word of God. They kind of smooth that over and make it a little less, you know, seemingly blasphemous. Nope. When you talk to Ahithophel, you were talking to one who had the wisdom of God. And both David and Absalom highly regarded the advice of Ahithophel. Everyone heard him, and he was a wise man. He gave advice that was worthy of listening to. And what's his advice? His advice is, listen, people are going to waver. They're not going to know where to stand. They're not going to know if you and your father are going to make peace. They need to see you clearly take steps to securing the kingdom and having sex with your father's concubines. We'll do that. Okay, you say, why is that a thing? I don't know. I don't know why that's a thing, but it was, right? Like, that was how you showed power, was by taking the previous king's concubines and having sex with them. You say, that's ridiculous and kind of silly. I agree. It is ridiculous and silly. But you know what? I mean, if you want a really vulgar explanation of why that is, it's you're literally taking and going everywhere that the previous king went, right? It's kind of like putting on the previous king's clothes. I could get very graphic here. I'm not going to, but I think you can kind of draw that out in your own mind. Obviously he's having sex with a bunch of women who were his dad's girlfriends, right? Like there's nothing churchy about this. There's nothing very, you know, clean and clear and under control about this whole thing. You know, ClearSale's not making a commercial about this. This is pretty grotesque and just vulgar, crass stuff. You can, like I said, I'll leave it to your imagination to figure out why that was a thing, but I think you can probably take a pretty good guess. But what is the purpose of this? Well, one, it shows that you're not willing to make peace with David. It says, it gives strength to your followers to know, okay, this is going to be a war, and this is going to be a total war, and there's not going to be peace afterwards. I'm not going to cut bait and run and leave you guys to pay the bill. Which, by the way, if you've studied Scottish history, happened over and over and over. Okay? You know, like, especially the last with Bonnie Prince Charlie. You know, just like, he's like, hey guys, thanks for fighting for me and losing to the English, but I'm going to go back to France, so have fun being sold as slaves to Barbados. You know, it's like, he didn't actually say that, I don't think. But the point is, he's saying, look, I'm going to go so far that there's going to be no safety for me either. So we're all in this together. And because he's going to take this step of having security and power, it's going to embolden those who are on the side of Absalom. Okay? Basically, what's Absalom doing? He's burning his boats. He's burning his boats, and he's saying, I'm in this. I mean, this is diving in head first. You know? Have you ever dived into a shallow pond? Because I have. It's pretty scary. I dived into a shallow pond and I didn't know it was a shallow pond. And you know what? All of a sudden, I'm doing a headstand on the bottom, on the sandy bottom. And I'm like, dear Lord, did I just break my neck? Am I going to drown? When you dive headfirst into something, it's normally good to do a depth check first. Sometimes you have to dive in headfirst. Sometimes there's no other option. Sometimes there are other options. But Absalom, he dives in head first. And what we see here, I think that the lesson we're learning, the lesson that we're supposed to draw from just this short section, is that in life, sometimes we do things that require us to dive in head first. The wisest man in Israel said, look, if you're going to do this rebellion thing, you have to go all the way. You cannot have half measures. The people will not support you if they think you're not in it to win it. You need to be fully committed to this. Fully committed. You have to be fully committed. You cannot be half in, half out. You can't wade into the water. You've got to dive in head first. That's the lesson. Is that sometimes in life we have to dive in head first. But you know what happens? When we dive in head first into something sinful, it ends up working for our destruction. Sometimes you have to dive in head first. But if you dive in head first to sin, you're going to be destroyed. You will be destroyed. It will be your downfall. Now, I admit, Absalom didn't have a choice. He didn't have a choice. This is if he tried to pussyfoot around and try to win in the legions here, win in the legions there, but not really take the steps necessary to fully offend his father, to fully make himself obnoxious to David, people wouldn't really know if the rebellion was real, and they would not be willing to risk their lives for it. You know, you don't risk your life for somebody who thinks he might want to be king. Okay? Like, that's not how rebellions work. You risk your life for somebody who wants to be king or die. Well, the Scottish do, because my ancestors were fools. But you don't risk your life for people who are like, maybe I'll be king. I don't know. Let's try it out. Let's see. You know, I like nice clothes. I like palaces. Those are fun. No, you don't do that. Sometimes you have to dive head first. But if you dive head first into sin, beware. Because in the end, it will destroy you. Anyways, that is all we have. Next week, we are going to get into chapter 17. And chapter 17 is a phenomenal chapter. We're probably going to have to divide chapter 17 into two places. Maybe we can get it all. And then chapter 18, we're going to have at least two sections in chapter 18. And then we've got chapter 19. So... I think we'll finish the fall of David. I think we'll get that finished. By next week we'll be done with that. So, and then we'll get back to David reigning and ruling, without his son trying to kill him. So hopefully we'll get that done next week, unless we just come up against it and we've got so much material, we just can't keep going. So I thank you for your time this week, and I hope you've been enjoying this Bible study, and I hope you have a great day. God bless. Bye.